Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're having a roundtable discussion about Wisconsin wildlife and nature today. I really look forward to these programs. About every 3 months or so, we have our three guests come by to talk with you and with me about what's going on in the outdoors from their perspectives. Dean Bortz, one of them, editor of Wisconsin Outdoor News. Enjoy reading Wisconsin Outdoor News. Dean Bortz, thanks for joining us today by phone.
Yes, good morning, Larry. Glad to be here.
And Patrick Durkin, a freelance writer and editor and president of the Wisconsin Outdoor Communicators Association. Pat, welcome back.
Always a pleasure.
Right. And Tim Isley in the studio with me, full-time freelance outdoor writer and photographer. And Tim, it's great to see you once again as
Thanks,
well.
Thanks, Larry. Great to be here and happy to be on with you.
We have a lot of topics, I think, to talk about, and certainly as you listen to these guys talk, I hope you'll join in the conversation. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org. What's on your mind as far as the outdoors goes? There's lots of things to go and talk about. And since you were last on, you guys, we have a new DNR secretary. How do you feel about the selection? Tim, start with you.
Well, Larry, it's been really interesting because I've watched Preston Cole since he's been on the Natural Resources Board. He's served on the board for 12 years. And it's really interesting because he has a background in natural resources. He came from a small farm up in Michigan. He worked for the Missouri Conservation Department, has a degree in forestry. So the guy has got a background in natural resources, which I think is really important. But the other thing is that I've watched him on the Natural Resources Board when he became chair of the board, how sometimes some people sitting in the audience would want to make some comments, and some board members in the past would say, no, we don't accept comments here. Well, they do if you sign up in advance. But Preston Cole, when he became chair of the board, this gentleman came out, he walked out in front of the board, and he addressed the people, the citizens who were sitting there in the audience, and he said, here's what we are going to do, and here are basically the rules that we operate by. And when it's your turn to speak, we are going to pay our undivided attention to you. I've been very impressed by him, and I think it's going to be really interesting. Obviously, we're going to have to wait and see how he does, but I was up at the Senate committee hearing. He has to be confirmed by the state Senate.
Right.
So he's been appointed by the governor, and he has to be confirmed by the Senate. So I was up at the Capitol last Thursday, and it was very interesting because some of the things that he's going to do. He said he's going to appoint a new science and technology officer to be an advisor to the legislature on certain things and bring more science in. So the things that he said so far, I'm very impressed with. I think he's going to be a strong leader, and he's going to bring science back into the DNR, and I think that's really important.
Yeah. Dean, do you think, what's your impression, Dean, and do you think he's going to sail through the nomination or the approval?
Not sure if sail would be the right word, Larry. But, I mean, he should be approved. I agree with Tim. I think Preston's an excellent choice. I know that Senator Tom Tiffany grilled Preston pretty hard during the hearing process. But I think afterward, talking to a few folks afterwards, I think Senator Tiffany was fairly impressed with Preston. Now, whether he's going to, call an executive session and have a vote, I'm sure he will. We'll see what happens, during that. I would think that at some point Preston will be appointed. I think the Senate will go ahead and, let him do that work. But sale might not be the right word. We'll see what happens there. I don't know how long this is going to take. I wouldn't think there's no reason for it to take very long, but we'll see what happens.
Yeah. Well, we've got this administrative change, and, we look at funding. Pat, maybe you can talk about this a little bit. In terms of CWD funding in the new budget proposal, or maybe the lack of it.
Yeah, that caused a lot of head-scratching and wonder. you know, that Tony Evers, our new governor, didn't have anything in the budget about it, not even a footnote about CWD. And there was a lot of effort in the past, you know, 6 months or so to raise that kind of awareness by people, well, like Fred Clark, different folks involved in the conservation community. So it's not like it was overlooked in the discussions, you know, leading into the budget. So why it wasn't there, we, you know, I really haven't gotten a good answer on that, why they just kind of overlooked that. You know, there's, you know, some people tried to explain it away by saying that we're waiting to hear what the final results are in this ongoing research in southwestern Wisconsin. But it seems to me that we really see what direction that's going. It's basically confirming what most people thought, or most of the experts thought about CWD. So I just thought that was kind of an excuse, not so much as a real explanation.
Yeah. Well, CWD is certainly a big concern in the state. Dean, there was some talk about a breakthrough in CWD, and somebody was even talking about an actual cure. Did you saw that information? I talked to Scott Craven about it, and Scott wasn't too impressed.
Right, that's the stuff coming out of Pennsylvania, and I know Pat's covered that particular topic pretty thoroughly in some of the writing he's done so far on it since that news has come out. When that came out of Pennsylvania, I was bombarded with phone calls, emails, and letters from our readers saying, "Hey, you know, hallelujah, here it is, we got the solution. You know, you need to get it on the front page." Well, yeah, boy, I'm not sure that this is the answer. I mean, if CWD is sourced by bacterium, I think we'd have discovered that a long time ago. So, you know, we certainly can wait and see what comes out of the work being done there. But as far as this being the answer, I'm not sure that's, you know, I don't think we know that yet. And I don't think we should be too excited about it at this point.
And it's Pat, you did write quite a bit about it. What's your thoughts on it?
Yeah, it's interesting, Larry, how I happened to be at a deer conference that week when that news broke, and it was fascinating how many people sent me links to this video that showed the spokesman for the United Sportsmen of Pennsylvania announcing this big breakthrough. And gosh, you start looking into it and you realize I was scratching my head because I remember writing about some of these theories at least 10 years ago, you know, not too long after we found CWD in Wisconsin. There was discussion among some scientists about whether really this was, the explanation we always hear is that it's triggered by misformed proteins called prions. And then there's this other scientist, a couple other ones are saying, no, that's just the residue of a bacterial infection. Well, the science has really gone pretty strong, hard and heavy on the idea that this is a prion disease. They are just not finding anything credible to suggest it's coming from a bacteria. So, I think it was just this yesterday or so. When the National Wildlife Association groups issued a statement pretty much debunking the whole thing. So
wow.
I guess I'm with Scott Craven on that one.
All right. You can join in, too, as you listen to these guys talk at 1-800-642-1234. Questions about what we've been talking about already or comments? Or maybe about some other things that are going on in the world of the outdoors here in Wisconsin. Again, it's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And actually, we have Gary online from Ween. Gary, thank you for calling. What's on your...
Good morning, Larry. Appreciate your shows all the time. I have just two quick comments. One is, I am hoping we have a return to science-based decisions instead of politically based decisions. And this includes the deer farms where they have the canned hunts complaining that they can't make it financially if they have to put up double fencing and all these things. Well, they're a big part of the spread of the disease, and so for their financial gain, the rest of the state should suffer. And the other comment I had was at the Mead Wildlife Center up in southern Marathon County, they had a speaker named Frank Pratt, who's a retired DNR fish biologist.
Yep.
And a very knowledgeable man, and he gave a presentation on the decline of cold water species in relationship to global warming. And I wish that a lot, it was fairly well attended. He spoke at a number of different places in the area. But as someone who enjoys trout fishing, the future of brook trout fishing in Wisconsin is very questionable. So thanks again for the great show, Larry.
Oh, Gary, thank you so much. Well, got two or three things there to talk about. Tim, do you want to start?
Sure. Well, I certainly agree with what Gary says, and we're hoping that science will again be back front and center with the Department of Natural Resources. And I think it was interesting that the new secretary had indicated that they are going back to the University of Wisconsin to the scientists to get a take on climate change and global warming, and they're going to be taking that information back. And I think you're going to be finding that that will be now back on the website for the Department of Natural Resources, and it's going to be a consideration. I remember years ago, we were up at the Wisconsin Outdoor Communicators Association in Eagle River, and we had a DNR fish manager talking about the change in climate. And as people have said in the past, where it's going to be warming and Wisconsin will be maybe more similar to Missouri than what we've had in Wisconsin. And brook trout are of concern because they need the clean water and cold water. So those are concerns, and so I agree it's something to be looked at. I think also something that came out of the Senate committee testimony last week regarded when we were talking about chronic wasting disease, that it came out that basically Michigan has put like $5 million, I think, into a study at Michigan State University on trying to get a test that will show CWD sooner, and Wisconsin is going to be watching that. And Preston Cole, the new secretary designee, had indicated that when the governor, Governor Evers, becomes chair of the new Great Lakes Governor's Council, one of the things he's going to do is put chronic wasting disease up at the top of the list there. So I think those are some things that will be coming up in the future that we hope will help out.
Oh, Gary, thank you so much for calling. There was also the deer farms issue that came up. Dean, a comment on that?
Well, I'm going to stick my head in the guillotine right now. But, that disease, I don't think, got here on its own. I'm fairly convinced it came by truck from somewhere out west and got here through deer that were released either in fences or on large chunks of private property that weren't fenced, but that the landowners hoped they could contain the deer. When I say contain, I mean, keep them relatively close onto this property in southern Wisconsin. I know we've heard all kinds of rumors about where it might have come from, but that one keeps popping up. It didn't get here. I don't think it got here by wild deer. I think it came on a truck. And if there's anything we could do to keep it contained inside fences, double fencing just seems to be the way to go. Be one thing that we could do that would keep farm deer from easily contacting wild deer.
Yeah, there's a lot more that I think could be done, and probably more that we could even talk about here. Our guest today, Dean Boritz, editor of Wisconsin Outdoor News, Pat Durkin, a freelance writer and editor, president of the Wisconsin Outdoor Communicators Association, and Tim Isley, full-time freelance outdoor writer and photographer. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our producer today. Dave Potratz, our engineer. You are listening to the Ideas Network. Before we get back to our guests, I want to say a big thank you to the more than 2,400 members who contributed during our spring membership drive. You donated more than $440,000. Really glad to welcome more than 500 new members to our family. Independent journalism, meaningful conversations, and world-class music have a home and an impact. And thank you so much for your support for this program and for all the programs that we have here. And today on the program, we're talking with Dean Bortz, editor of Wisconsin Outdoor News, Pat Durkin, freelance writer and editor, president of the Wisconsin Outdoor Communicators Association, and Tim Isley, who's full-time freelance outdoor writer and photographer. And we have a lot of people on the line who want to visit with you guys, so let's go back to the phone. Mary in Pewaukee will go to you next. Hi, Mary.
Yes, hi, Larry and guests. Yeah, I really am very upset about the attack on Mona, as I call her, the first two letters of Mother and Nature. And now I see that monies for the Great Lakes is being taken away, or the plan, I should say, the new budget from the administration. So I think all of us can do well by making sure that we vote for all of our representatives, because money taken away from the Great Lakes, which is a very limited fresh water in our world, and I think the only in our nation. Can I get some feedback from your guests today, Larry, on that?
Okay. Well, Dean Bortz, let's go to you first.
I'm not familiar with any money being drawn away from any Great Lakes projects. Tim, I know Tim looked at the budget a little bit closer than I did. Tim, have you seen anything about that?
Well, I think she may be referring to the president's new budget that he just released a couple days ago, and I think in that there's been all sorts of cuts, and I think that's what she's referring to, and basically I think it's up to people to contact your Congress people and senators and let them know that the Great Lakes are really important to us, but I think that's maybe what Mary's referring to.
Yeah, I think so as well. And it's something I want to keep your eye on. And if you're in favor of that funding, you better be contacting your representatives. That's the message I'm hearing from Tim and our caller. Well, Joe and Madison, your turn. Hi, Joe.
Hey, I actually had a question about the Great Lakes as well. I'm curious about how the decisions are made and weighed about extracting water for like commercial purposes in other states. do states as a collective, the Great Lakes states as a collective, make those decisions? If not, why not? And what other like major issues are, as far as Great Lakes are concerned, are present right now.
Mm-hmm. Tim, do you want to take a crack at that?
Well, I think to the best of my knowledge, it's basically a lot of that is determined through the Great Lakes Compact. That was approved years ago, fortunately. And basically, those communities that are withdrawing water, which come out of the Great Lakes water basin, basically they're allowed to do it, but then there's a compact that says they can't take out more, or places outside that boundary can't take out more. Of course, that was a concern when Foxconn came up here in Wisconsin. And the question is how much water we're withdrawing. But I think the Great Lakes Compact is what governs those decisions.
Yeah. And there's
Tim's right about that. And then there's also it's part of that compact, and Ontario is part of that too. There's a map drawn as part of that compact to indicate which communities along the lakes can withdraw water, and like Tim said, then how much.
And there's a book, and I'm blanking for Joe here. There's a book on the Great Lakes that was part of the UW's Go Big Read program, and it's the death, I think the title is The Death and Life. Or is it the life and death of the great? I think it's the death and life of the Great Lakes.
I think you're right. And just another thing to mention is that the DNR now, one of the assistants that President Cole has hired is Todd Ames, who is a specialist on Great Lakes water issues, and he will be working at the Department of Natural Resources.
Mm-hmm. And Dean, was that you, Dean, that was going to comment, or was it?
I was just saying that you're referring to Dan Egan's book,
yes.
Death and Life of the Great Lakes.
Dan Egan's book, yeah, he's a nice guy. I had a nice visit with him here a month or two ago. Interesting book for sure. So, Joe, I'd recommend you take a look at that book for sure, The Death and Life of the Great Lakes. Dan Egan talks about a lot of issues relating to our Great Lakes. And James in Antigo will give you a chance. Hi, James.
Hello. You know, I'd like to see the writers bring some attention to this threat of sulfide mining that's hanging over our heads in the state. All of your listeners who are fishermen, hunters, or second homeowners have no idea that their drinking water at their up north cabin or cottage is in jeopardy. And this affects the Wisconsin River, the Wolf River, Peshtigo, Elkanto, you name it. They're just as people in the South have no idea that we passed this Act 134 last year that makes it so that they can dig up these multitude of sulfide deposits up here in the North Woods that will affect all this and ruin all this land.
Well, let's get a comment. Who wants to comment? Dean, you want to comment?
Yeah, I might as well take that one since we're working on a newspaper here. We are going to be doing work on mining. I've been talking to a gentleman. I cannot recall his name. He's over near the Menominee River, and that might be the most well-known effort currently underway. It's actually going to be the mine is proposed for on the Michigan side of the Menominee. But of course, if they mine over there, the water runs, it's going to affect Wisconsin too. But then, I live almost on the border of Oneida and Vilas counties, and we've got the Willow Flowage in our area. And, there's been a number of efforts over the years to, in the town of Lynn, township of Lynn, to open a sulfide mine there in a large wetland area. And so far, nothing has really happened with that, but there's another effort underway right now to get the Lynn mine going. And, sure it's going to, there's a huge chance for it to impact groundwater, surface water. And, we do need to work on some of that, and we will be doing that coming up this summer.
So that's from Dean Bortz, editor of Wisconsin Outdoor News. James, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. So that's, James, that's some a paper you ought to pay some attention to as time goes on here. Ed in Middleton, we'll go to you next. Hi, Ed.
Oh, yeah, this is Ed. I just read an article a couple weeks ago where I'm talking about the CRW disease. They take that thing from the deer, and they found out now it is transferable to another animal. I can't remember what it was, maybe a lab animal. And they always said it won't be transferred to the human, but why would it go to a lab animal and not to a human?
Yeah, well, that's a question. Let's go to Pat Durkin, who's done a lot of research on and work on this.
Yeah, he might be referring to a study that last year that came out where the preliminary results, the study's not done yet, but it's the preliminary stuff was pretty frightening. They were able to document that the CWD could transfer to the macaque monkey. And other efforts, though, in other labs haven't been able to do that. So that one's still kind of up for debate. But the thing that's so tricky in all this research, and that's one thing people should keep in mind, it is a fairly new disease to humans. There's not a big wealth of science out there behind us to inform us on these things. But what we know so far, though, is that when you do these tests, they're taking samples, CWD samples, from different parts of these deer. Might be the brains in some cases, might be the meat in some cases. And the study up in Canada that found that it did transfer, those tissue samples came from meat from infected deer and fed over a long period of time. The concern is that when you get the steady diet of infected meat, that it could transfer. But a quick injection, like from, or a quick, we call it, transfer of materials from like brain tissue wasn't doing that to the macaque monkey. So you have all these different little nuances in the research. It's really hard to say for certain, you know, what the end result will be. But the one thing I took away from a recent presentation, I watched a couple of them at the Southeast Deer Study Group meeting in Louisville about a month ago. And the thing that came through there was that the thing they're trying to really drive home to people is that it's early. There's still pretty good evidence that there is a species barrier between, CWD and humans. But in the meantime, get your animals tested when you shoot them, and then wait for the results to come back before you start feeding the material, even feeding the meat to your family. And to me, that I still think is the most sensible way, where we don't panic about this because we don't know the answers yet. But the chances of it transferring to humans, even if they find it can transfer, will probably be very, very low. But still, you know, be safe.
Yeah, be safe. Ed, thanks again. Randy in Wisconsin Rapids, we move to you next. Hi, Randy.
Hello. I'm wondering why the turkey season has to be as complicated as it is, with the different zones and the different time slots and stuff. I have two minor sons, and this year me and my one son got permits, but not my youngest. And like, if you go partridge hunting, we just pick a weekend and go. I guess I don't understand why it has to be so complicated.
It is a little complicated. There's some reasons behind it. Tim, you want to?
Sure, Larry, I'd be happy to. I think you have to go back to the history of the turkey season here in Wisconsin. The modern season here started in the early 1980s. We used to have turkeys originally, and then, of course, we cut down the woods and we shot them all, and so they disappeared until we brought them back live trap from Missouri. So we started the season here in Wisconsin in the early 1980s, and if one of the things, of course, the turkeys were on private land. So they started a season. It was only a half day long, and you had to apply and get a permit. And they've expanded the season statewide. They have zones. And basically, to manage the season, to me, the best advantage to what we have in Wisconsin is that we have a quality hunt. It's a quality hunt. You have so many permits per zone, per time period. You apply for those, and then you go out. Rather than having all sorts of people out at the same time, I've hunted down in Missouri and been down in Missouri when you've got everybody out. Missouri's a big turkey state, and it's unbelievable. And also, those turkeys clam up right away. They don't gobble very much. So I think I can understand his concern, Randy's concern about that, but it's a quality hunt, and you can... Now you can get extra permits. The leftover permits will go on sale next Monday, starting, I believe, in Zone 1. So that if you apply for a permit, then you can get an extra permit, and often people will get two or three permits and be able to hunt. So I can understand the concern there, but we've got a quality hunting experience right now, and to me, that's the top.
Yeah, that's the top priority, I think. And by the way, Randy and everybody else for that matter, on April 10th, I've got the whole show dedicated to turkeys. So Dan Small's going to come on first and talk about the new show that he's put out on the turkeys in Wisconsin and the turkey hunt. And then following that, guide and Jeff Friedrich, who has... he's an amazing guy. He's quite an artist, and he's also quite a guide and turkey hunter. I've had him on one other time. We had a great time. So that's April 10th we'll be talking about, and that's just ahead of the youth hunt, which is a couple days later. Tim, you were going to add.
I was just going to mention that last week at the Senate confirmation hearing, the DNR secretary designee had mentioned, because there is concern over complicated regulations, fishing and hunting, and he has asked Scott Lumens, who is the administrator over fish, wildlife, and enforcement, to put together a sample booklet of regulations that would be a little more generic and would simplify some of the regulations, and then go out to the public and have them take a look at it and see, is this what you want? So it's sort of going along the lines of what Randy's saying. and maybe seeing, are some of these regulations too complicated, and can they be simplified a little bit, easier to understand? So I think that's coming in the future.
All right, there we go.
Larry, if you have just a second here, I could jump in on this too for just a little bit. This is Ian.
Yeah.
Actually, our turkey season is less complicated than it used to be. We have fewer zones, so there's less to deal with there. You can hunt larger areas. And as far as, I'm not sure, the gentleman didn't say how old his kids were, but it sounded to me like he wanted to take them both or all three, I don't know how many kids he has, but wanted to take them all at the same time. He could do that during the youth hunt if they fit that category. They could all go at once then.
Yeah, 15 or younger.
Yeah, and then, but otherwise, I mean, I've taken my kids, different kids hunting, they even if they don't have a tag, they can still go along on the hunt. They just won't be able to shoot one at that time period. And then when that kid's tag comes up later on, then the kid that had the earlier tag can still go with them. So it still works out, I think. I think it works great.
My daughter, this will be her last year for the youth hunt. So I'm looking forward to that one more time. It's a great opportunity.
Can I chime in with one observation too, Larry?
Sure, Pat.
Yeah, people often talk, and this is an issue I've been covering for almost 40 years now, about how complicated our hunting and fishing regulations are. The thing I always have to remind people is typically the complications, the things that trip people up and get them mad, are not coming from the Department of Natural Resources. Typically they come up through public input, where everyone wants to fine-tune, tweak, add their little pet thing into the process. And that's really what drives so many of our complicated regulations. So I guess I'd say recognize where this stuff comes from. It's typically ourselves monkeying with things without really often wondering or concerning ourselves with how other people will respond to it.
Yeah, there we go. Thank you again for that question. Marilyn in Sun Prairie will give you a chance. Hi, Marilyn.
Hello.
Hi, thanks. What's on your mind?
Well, it's my understanding that we use dogs to hunt bears on public land, and that when the dog is killed, we reimburse the hunter for the death of his dog with public funding. Is that true?
You want me to grab that one, Larry?
Dean, go ahead.
Yes, it is true. It came to be as part of the Wolf Restoration Program, and when the caller says killed, it isn't they don't get paid out if the dog dies of old age. It's if during part of the hunt, if a dog is killed by a wolf and the loss can be confirmed. And it's not just dogs; it's also livestock. But the loss has to be able to be verified as caused by a wolf. And that's done by the USDA Wildlife Services folks who are, trained to do that kind of work. And if the loss is verified as caused by a wolf, then yes, the person can, submit paperwork to be reimbursed for the dog, the cow, the sheep, whatever it might be. There's a limit on what can be paid out, and the person who receives the payment also has to pay income tax on that. So if, let's say, you lose a dog or, let's say a dog that you've had for 3 or 4 or 5 years, you do get reimbursed for its death, but then you have to pay income tax on your pet.
So there it is, Marilyn. I know there's been some concern among people. Why should we be paying for somebody's dog if the dog dies? But that's the way the rules are now, and that's the way the regulations are. So there you go, Marilyn. Thank you for calling. Mike in Racine County, it's your turn.
Hi. I just wanted to expand on those comments about where the complications and regulations come. First of all, I'm a past member of the Conservation Congress, and was very involved in how things came up through that process. And but the observation when it comes down to the last analysis, there has been more inputs to the details in the regulation about how this county gets this or how this area gets broken up or how the compensation for the that you just talked about, compensation for animal loss and all that, that is coming from the legislature from the most part.
Yeah.
And I would be so far to say it's coming more from the Republican legislature than the Democratic legislature, because the Democratic legislature tended to say, DNR, you're the regulatory agency. Your job is to develop the regulations, you know, and we will appropriate money and funding for programs. Whereas the Republicans, in addition to the funding and appropriation, they also wrote into law or pressured and cajoled with the appropriations specific regulations to suit industry and or special interest groups within their purview.
Well, let's see. Let's get a comment on that. Pat, do you want to comment?
Yeah, I have to agree that typically, historically in Wisconsin, going back into the 40s in the time of all the Leopold, you know, Leopold and the people back then got really tired of dealing with all the hunting and fishing issues in the legislature. So they basically turned and said, you know, let's put this in under the guidance, the direction of our conservation department back then, with advising powers coming from the Conservation Congress and other avenues, you know, public avenues like that. And then, you know, that system, I remember, Larry, going to hearings back in the 90s quite often and having delegates from the Conservation Congress showing up and really getting mad when the legislature was trying to change something without going through the Congress. And then about, you know, starting about, you know, 10 years ago or so, it really was more from the Republicans than Democrats where they started taking back that kind of oversight and starting to put it back into the legislature where you're having, you know, passing laws without really a whole lot of input. We had this, these cases now, people are still mad about the fact how much our deer registration system changed, you know, with no public input, you know. So I have to agree with them. I'm not going to argue with that one.
Talking about the world of wildlife here in Wisconsin with our three guests, Dean Boritz, editor of Wisconsin Outdoor News, Pat Durkin, a freelance writer and editor, president of the Wisconsin Outdoor Communicators Association, and Tim Isley, full-time freelance outdoor writer and photographer. You can join in, too, at 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to our quarterly, I guess we could call it, about every 3 months, Nature and Wildlife Writers Roundtable, and having a lot of fun talking with our three guests, Dean Boritz, Pat Durkin, and Tim Isley. And certainly lots of people are online with questions for you guys. Here's one that Gary from Berlin, he wanted to know where all the smelt runs are. You guys know anything about that? Not a smelt run? I'm not hearing anybody.
No. Not my area of expertise.
I'm not sure what he's asking about there. What was that, snow run?
Where are the smelt runs?
Oh, smelt runs. All right. Sorry about that. This is Dean. Smelt runs have been very light from my, what I've known lately here is we don't see the smelt runs like we used to on the Great Lakes. I grew up in southern Ashland County, and I can remember grandfathers and uncles and dads and everybody heading to Ashland to make a haul on smelt in the spring. And it still happens, but I don't think to the extent that it used to. And this year, of course, we're going to be a little early for that right now. But I'm not sure what's happening on Lake Michigan. I haven't heard too much over that way. We do have some inland lakes in Oneida Vilas County that have smelt in them that we wish didn't have smelt. Fence Lake and Lac du Flambeau is one where if you can get permission from a landowner there, you could probably go out and catch a few smelt. Diamond Lake's a small one just north of Arborvita. It's got some smelt in it.
So there's a few out there, but not like back when I was a kid. Man, oh, man, oh, man. They used to eat a lot of smelt, and those smelt runs were fun. They were actually fun to do, for sure. Yeah. Don in plover. I want to go to you next. Don, hello.
Hello. How are you guys today?
Good. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Well, I'm kind of a seasoned hunter over the years, and I've been hunting for 50-some years. And I am in northern Wisconsin, and I've talked to some bear hunters along the side of the road this fall, and they were kind of bragging that they had up to 24 bear permits to shoot bear, and they were hound dog runners. And I thought that was a little excessive, but maybe it's because they got their relatives, and I don't know how that all works. But then I talked to a guy down south from Plover area where I was at, and he was a hound guy too, and he said that he had permits to shoot up to 12 bobcat. And I don't know how they do that. So how does that work? It doesn't seem ethically right that they should have a chance to shoot all these animals when I'm a property owner and I don't even I can't even get a tag up here because I'll be too old by then.
All right. Well, who wants to take that on?
I can. This is Dean. I'm familiar with that sport. So when they say they have 24 tags or 12 or however many, they don't personally have that many. What they're doing is taking out friends or maybe they're guiding. And so they'll have people who are holding tags that they're going to take hunting during the season. But they don't have 24 people in their group who each have a tag. And that's what they're talking. Same with bobcats. You know, they'll be like, if I draw a bobcat or a bear tag, I'll go with somebody who has dogs and I'd be one of the permits that they're talking about. It's not their permit, it's my permit. So that's how that's referenced.
Got it.
Yeah, could I say there too, Larry?
Yeah, go ahead, Pat.
Yeah, the one thing that I think is really commendable in our country and in our state is that the application process and the distribution of licenses and hunting licenses, fishing licenses, you name it, it's a very democratic process. This is not something you can't really game it. You can't really get the individual special treatment that some folks wish they could just buy and do it. Wisconsin has done a very good job to scientifically manage its populations and distribute the hunting and fishing licenses in a way that everyone gets a crack at them. You know, we all pay the same amount for them. We all have the same dates. We got to apply for special permits. So, you know, Dean's got it right. This is all being regulated very carefully. No one's stockpiling the stuff. And the thing with bear hunting, you can do it with a group of people. You go out and make it more of a joint effort where it's a fun thing to get people together for. So I don't think there's anything to be too concerned there about in that regard.
Okay. Thanks, Don. Appreciate the call. Jan in Monticello, your turn. Hi, Jan.
Oh, good morning. I'd like to tell Patrick Durkin that I really enjoyed your column in the State Journal, and I don't see it anymore. Have you discontinued that?
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. It's been a tough year for me that way. what you're seeing is what unfortunately our newspaper industry is suffering, and they're making cuts. And so the State Journal at the end of January ended its outdoor coverage, and I was cut out of the process at that point. So it wasn't targeted toward me. They just pretty much ended their outdoor coverage.
What I can mention is that if you wanted to read Wisconsin Outdoor News, you'll see Pat's material right in there.
Thank you, Dean.
You're welcome, Pat.
Sorry about that.
There you go, Jan. Thanks for calling. Appreciate your call. And let's see. We take another call. Let's go to Rick and Rhinelander next. Hi, Rick.
Yes, hello.
Hi. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, I'd kind of like to make a comment similar to one that the previous caller, or several back a previous caller, in regard to what has happened with our legislature. One of the things, I live here in the North Woods, and one of the things that has bothered me is sort of the protections that have gone away for our lakes. And for instance, the shoreline zone, it used to be that there were local controls on what could be done for developments of lakes. And of course, our fishing and quality of our water is dependent on that shoreland not being overdeveloped or being developed in an inappropriate way. And I'm concerned about that. I'd be interested in your panel's ideas on that. And then the second item would be Act 134, this getting rid of the mining moratorium. I live not far from the town of Lynn, where there is a proposed sulfide mine that could impact the Willow Flowage, which is an outstanding water resource. And there's been a tremendous push for the development of that mine. Fortunately, we had a referendum up here, and the citizens of Oneida County voted. Unfortunately, it's advisory only, but they voted almost 2-1 against developing that mine on county land. So I'm just interested in your panel's thoughts on this, because I've become increasingly alarmed. I retired up here to fish and hunt and do all the things I like to do and have healthy forests and clean water, and it seems like we're going in the opposite direction.
All right. Well, let's see. Tim, you want to start this time?
Well, I'd be happy to. I'm right there with Rick. I think when you look at what has happened in Wisconsin, it used to be, of course, that the Natural Resources Board, their citizens appointed by the different governors, and they are there to make decisions. But information comes up from the scientists at the Department of Natural Resources, and where the social science would come in is at the Natural Resources Board, and they would be making decisions on what people wanted and what the scientists said. And now what we're seeing is that the legislature has really taken over a lot of these things with natural resources, and they're passing these laws because they represent people. Well, people want to be able to do things. If they want to be able to build near water, if they want to shoot 10 species of this and that, they go to their legislators. And unfortunately, in my opinion, legislators have taken control, and they're now passing a lot of the natural resource legislation that should have been with the DNR and with the Natural Resources Board. So the only thing I can say in concern over mining, concern over clean water, we're seeing some of the things right now with some of the drinking water in southwest Wisconsin because some of the large confined animal operations. Well, these things have consequences, and we need the Natural Resource Department and the board to be able to set a lot of the regulations rather than what people want, what's good, I think, for natural resources in a clean environment. So I'm sympathetic with what Rick says.
Yeah, Tim, how about Pat?
Yeah, these are the kind of issues, Larry. I'm always glad you're doing these kind of programs because it helps us remind people that ultimately they're the ones making these decisions. If they don't hold their elected representatives accountable, these kind of things keep happening. And up in the North Woods, you know, we have elections. And the thing I tell people who accuse me of being too partisan this way or that way is I always remind them, you either straighten them out or you vote them out. And I can write and cover these different issues. Dean can publish this information, but ultimately it comes back to voters, individual people going out and making these decisions at the ballot box.
Dean, you want to add anything to that?
Sure, I can add a little bit. Having covered a lot of water issues in Oneida Vilas County, living there since 1986, I've become very familiar with zoning offices in both counties. And you talk about local government. Through all those years, I've always felt that, you know, just watching, covering the actions of the folks who are on the county boards and the committees in those counties, they've just done a super job of being able to allow recreation to occur in those two counties, two of our heaviest tourist counties, while still protecting the resource. And I'm not sure that we needed any other types of legislation coming along behind what those counties were doing, but those folks were doing a super job.
And Rick, I thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. What's the Jan had a question. The difference between hunting contests, including crows, and I'm wondering why these are okay, and why crows. I think Jan may have been on earlier, and I might have cut her off too soon. Dean, do you want to comment on that?
Sure. So there's been some discussion here lately about wildlife hunting contests following a bill that was submitted by Fred Risser. Fred picked it up from the national organization, HSUS, Humane Society of the United States, that's trying to get a similar bill or bill of this type passed in every state. And so Fred brought it into Wisconsin for HSUS. Really doesn't have any reason to be here. Our DNR takes care of our wildlife. With when I say DNR, I always mean in conjunction with input from sportsmen and the Conservation Congress. So I think we have things pretty well set up in the state. There's really no reason for concern. As far as the question about, you know, crows or coyotes, whatever it might be, I'm not familiar with every contest that goes on in the state, but I'm sure there's we have big buck contests during gun deer season, even during archery season, probably. We have live bird tournaments for people who own bird dogs. We have a number of different types of tournaments or contests. And so I don't have any problem with what we're doing. I think it's fairly well regulated.
On that note, we'll take a quick break here. Our guests today, Dean Boritz, editor of Wisconsin Outdoor News, Pat Durkin, freelance writer and editor, as is Tim Isley. Great to have them with us. They'll be here until 12:30. We'll take a look at the news, and then we'll be back. So you stay with us. Taking a look at nature and wildlife in Wisconsin today, Larry Mueller here with our three guests, Dean Boritz, editor of Wisconsin Outdoor News, Pat Durkin, freelance writer and president of the Wisconsin Outdoor Communicators Association, and Tim Isley, full-time freelance outdoor writer and photographer. Talking about a lot of different topics today, what questions or concerns do you have about nature and wildlife here in the state? Give a call at 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Harold in Burnham Wood's been waiting a while, so let's go there. Harold, thank you for waiting. What's on your mind?
Good afternoon to all. Reinforcing that the wrong people are passing the rules, which is our legislators, and in our case, and what I'm going to refer to as someone who has absolutely almost no outdoor background, I can go take a rod and reel and with a little luck, catch a very, very large fish and have the fun of catching it and letting it go, i.e. the catfish. And now this legislature has managed to, legislator got it through that now I could go shoot it with a bow, which makes it impossible to release, harvesting the big adults, which keep the generations going. And I just had never understood how, then it was, I guess, stuck with the DNR to find out how do we solve this can of worms that was just opened of shooting a game fish, not a rough fish of a carp or something, but a quality game fish of a huge catfish, shooting it with a bow, and that's a good thing, they think. And I just don't understand what our legislators, and we're allowing them to do it. The comment was made, we can control our legislators but not vote them in, but it just never seems to happen.
Yeah. Well, Tim, do you want to comment?
Well, I think it was a recent law that was passed that allowed noodling of catfish, and I think maybe then it was the using the bow and arrow to shoot catfish. I don't recall that exactly, but I think Harold has got a point. I mean, again, it comes up, it's a law, and they pass it, and in the past, you know, the interesting thing is that the Department of Natural Resources years ago, when laws would come up before the legislature, the Department of Natural Resources would be able to testify on the bill and be able to say whether they're for it or against it based on their science. And for the last 8 years, our DNR has been muzzled. They have not been able to go before the legislature. They could comment, but they couldn't take a position on a bill. And I think that will be changing in the future, but that's, we need the scientists at the DNR in order to provide some of the scientific basis. And I think that was a law that passed. And I think there is concern that the catfish has been a game fish, and you're sort of now moving it into the rough fish category. Yeah. And that could be a dangerous trend.
There you go, Harold. Thank you so much for that call and question. Let's go to Seth in Oregon next. Seth, hi, thanks for calling.
Hello. My question is, I'm just wondering what advice you would have for someone looking to get into the field of outdoor writing and outdoor photography? I graduated from UW-Stevens Point several years back with a degree in journalism and just didn't have the time to really pursue that career at the time, but I'm kind of looking to get back into it. So I'm just wondering what advice your guests might have.
Well, you've got three guys who should know a little bit about it. Well, let's see. Where do we even start? Dean, you want to start?
Sure. Yeah, I can start off on this one, although I'm sure Pat and Tim also have some good advice on this. Back in the day, and I'm talking back in the early 1980s when newspapers were still flourishing, I got some really good advice as a UW Green Bay College student from Dave Otto, who was one of the best outdoor writers Wisconsin ever produced, along with many others that we sit here and name. But Dave's advice to me when I had a chance to talk to him was get a job at a newspaper, learn the craft at that newspaper by covering town board meetings, school board meetings, whatever type of meeting it might be, or writing news stories. And then there you have an access to the news. So if you see something of an outdoor nature, then you could take that topic, write about it, and then try to sell it to an outdoor publication. And so that's how I got started, and that's what I did. I took his advice and did just that. I ended up working at the Lakeland Times in Minocqua, and I turned a lot of those stories into stories that I could sell to other newspapers or magazines. Nowadays, you have so many other options with social media, TV, YouTube, and stuff, so you can go in a lot of different directions, but that's how I got going.
Podcasts in there too.
Sure.
Well, Pat, what about you?
Yes, some of these ways that Dean and I and Tim came along are kind of going by the wayside. But I guess the idea I have that I often quote is Samuel Johnson was a great thinker and philosopher in England back in the 1700s. This is not a novel idea, but it's something we really got to keep in mind today if you want to make it as an outdoor writer, if you want to make it as a writer, period. And Johnson wrote, and I keep this above my desk, so I'm reading it right from my desk right now. He wrote, "No man but a blockhead ever wrote except for money. If you're always writing for free, you won't get very far. You know, you can. There's only so much time in the day, and eventually you got to make money at this." And so what I recommend people do is find, whether it's a small newspaper, whether it's a small magazine, whether it's a small anything that's paying you for your time to write that, get in with people who are professionals, who can actually take you somewhere if you perform for them. And one thing that one of my little secrets to making it as a freelancer full-time is that I do a lot of writing outside the outdoor area. And so if there's a trade group out there, almost every major trade in this country has magazines, publications you can write for. And so if you're a good reporter, you want to learn how to interview people and put together articles, seek out these different trade groups, whether it's in the hunting area, the fishing area, whatever it might be. There's typically areas you can find that will pay you for your time and make it worthwhile. And then once you start getting published and showing that you can deliver on time, you can deliver accurate information, you'll find work. But I have very little faith you're going to find it by doing your own personal blog. I just don't see that.
Yeah. Tim, what do you think?
Well, very, very similarly, I got into outdoor writing with an interest in, fortunately, I took a program by Clay Schoenfeldt at the University of Wisconsin, Madison here, and I've been able to tell Clay and Lloyd Boschian, John Ross, people who were important people for me, that I went into this conservation communications program, and I am able to do today exactly what I enjoy doing, but because of them, and I thank them for that. So the important thing is to get in. He sounds like he's already been to school at UW-Stevens Point, which is a great school. But with the concern over newspapers, now, I had a freelance writing class, and in order to get an A in the class, I had to sell an article. Well, I didn't realize that a lot of places used things written by freelancers. So I got a report, and I sold it to the State Journal and then the Green Bay Press Gazette, and that's the way I started. So, but I would agree that One of the things would be possibly going back to school and taking some classes in additional writing, but then selling. And I was going to say, like Pat indicated, some of these organizations, for a while I edited and produced a magazine for the Wisconsin Woodland Owners. There's other conservation groups. They have publications. You could start with writing for groups like that and getting paid and getting your foot in the door until a full-time position would come along. But I think the main thing is writing. The other thing, there are two organizations here in Wisconsin. We have the Wisconsin Outdoor Communicators Association. We meet each year up at Eagle River in July. There's also the national group, Outdoor Writers Association of America. And they will have programs for budding young writers who would like to do outdoor communications. And so those would be two groups that I would suggest that Seth contact.
Yeah, that national group. Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, Larry, I was going to also add one more group to the list of Tim's there. It's the Association, it's regional, Association of Great Lakes Outdoor Writers. It's another group that, you know, helps young writers come along and, you know, has conference, produces seminars, and gets that kind of stuff going.
Yeah, I had a number of, actually, our students in my department at the university received awards and from the National Outdoor Writers Association for their work and just for the studies that they were doing. And I can remember, as you guys were talking, I was thinking about what's the first story I sold. I sold a story to the Wisconsin State Journal on, they had an outdoor page then. Yep. About a third of the page was a photo of myself and my brother with a big muskie that I had caught. And then I sold a few photos. I see Seth's also a photographer. I sold some photos that wound up on fishing magazine covers, actually, so with some nice other muskies that I was able to catch. But you guys, that's a great advice, Seth. I think it was good of you to call. I hope you learned a little bit more about getting into this whole business of outdoor writing and photography. Thank you for calling. We have Roger and Racine next, I think. Roger, it's your turn.
Yes, thanks for taking my call, Larry.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a member of the Wisconsin Wildlife Federation, and the recent issue of Wisconservation, which is their newsletter, has an article by Tom Haug. Tom is a retired DNR specialist.
Yep.
And the question addresses, or the article addresses question 52 on the spring hearings, which has to do with paying for positive CWD deer. It's an advisory question, and obviously if the vote is in favor of it, it would have to have legislation to enact it. But I'd like the writers to comment on that subject, paying for positive CWD deer, and get their thoughts on what we can do to be proactive about the CWD situation.
Yeah, I interviewed him on the show, and we had a lot of comments on it. Well, Dean, what do you think?
Before I get into that answer, let me just make a plug for the spring hearings in the first place overall.
Yeah.
Every second Monday of April every year, this year it's going to be April 8th, you can go to your county. Every 72 counties, each county in the state will have a spring hearing conducted by the DNR and Conservation Congress, where we'll go over proposed fish wildlife rule changes on the DNR side, and then advisory questions, often from sportsmen themselves, from the Conservation Congress. And the caller's right. I'm looking at number 52 right now on my laptop, and I had it pulled up here for a while so we could talk about it. But it is a question about the payment for positives. And see, it's Foy. Is it Mike Foy?
Yeah,
retired
Mike.
DNR wildlife biologist who has been kind of working on this project here.
Yeah.
To get some attention to it. Yeah. It's a good idea. We need to do something here, and I think this is a good move. Maybe we can argue a little bit about how much we're going to pay for each positive and to who, but overall, I think the idea is real strong. And after reading letters to the editor in neighboring states, you know, this last week, and talking to people in neighboring states, they're like, you know, what can we do to make Wisconsin do something about CWD so it doesn't leak over the border to our state? And I think this is one good move right here.
Yeah. So, Roger, thank you so much for that. I just want to keep going on the Conservation Congress. Chris in La Crosse emailed that Pat finally gets his wish there would be an online option for participation in the hearings. You can register online at dnr.wi.gov and search spring hearings. I think input begins at 7 p.m. on April 8th, the same time the county right. meetings begin, and it lasts for 72 hours. So your opinion,
correct.
Yeah, the opinion gets counted right. in the overall results, right?
Well, this is Dean again. Kevin Nazi just finished an article on that for our next issue. And I learned a little bit reading Kevin's article this morning. It's not going to be online input is not going to be technically a vote. It'll be collected, but it won't be like if you're voting in person at your local county. So it will be, you can offer your opinions and ideas and thoughts online and they'll be gathered and counted, but it won't actually be a vote.
All right, there
now,
we.
What are they going to call? What are they going to do with it? I don't know, but you know what they'll.
Well, maybe it's but, the first step toward down the road, a few years down the road, or even next year. Who knows?
Well, and that's what Larry Bondi, the Conservation Congress chairman, is saying. He said, "Look, this is our first crack at this. We're going to do it this way this year. It's going to continue to evolve." We want to see where the information is coming from. We want to make sure that nobody can job the system. And so that's how they're handling it this year. You know, by next year, I'm sure they'll have more tweaks to it and then on down the road as well.
As long as we're on the Conservation Congress, what are some of the other things that are being considered that are on your radar, guys? Tim, I'll start with you, maybe.
Well, there are some really good questions that are going to be coming up this year. And one of the things about the payment for positives I want to go back to is just that if the vote, even if this is positive, it still has to be authorized by the budget bill of the state. So that some of these things, even though they're voted in favor, they still have to be put into either. Some of them will require legislation. But another one would restore deer tagging requirements. This, again, also would require legislation, but years ago we used to tag the deer and people had confidence, I think, in the numbers that were brought in, and then the legislature did away with tagging of deer. And another question that I'm interested in is a question that would support a statewide ban on baiting and feeding of deer. That's something that a lot of people have been concerned about because of chronic wasting disease. Another question for upland hunters would require pheasant, grouse, and quail hunters to wear blaze orange or pink. And I think that's interesting mm-hmm. because when you're wearing blaze orange, you can be seen. And, of course, we are required to do that for deer. But this would be for upland hunters. I think it would just be an additional safety thing. So there's some really good questions coming up.
Yeah. Anything that strikes your fancy, Pat?
Yeah. A couple of different things caught my attention. Right, you know, I live here in Waupaca County, so we're just north of the Winnebago system, and there's a question on there about reducing the walleye bag limit from 5 fish per day to 3 fish per day. And also, you know, there's a number of regulation changes they're proposing for the Mississippi River pools along, you know, our western border. So that's going to be interesting to see where that goes. And there's also, it gets complicated, but it's one of these interesting ideas where they're talking about for bass tournaments changing from like the local bass regulation to the statewide standard, you know, for just for the benefit of the tournaments. So you have that whole can of worms to get into with fishing tournaments. A lot of stuff. And another one that caught my interest was Lake Winnebago, our famous sturgeon spearing season. It's become a thing for some folks in recent years to use underwater cameras, you know, as an aid when they're out there spearing, and that's got some of the traditional spearers really upset, you know, that people are putting cameras down beneath the ice to see what's down there, and they don't think that camera should be allowed. And they also have a rule proposal for spearing sturgeon where the actual spear itself has to fit certain parameters. You can't just go out there with these. It's always been kind of a interesting
development that comes along where you have certain guys get pretty good at making spears, so they start making super duper spears that are real wide catch area, lots more tines on the spears. So they're talking about, you know, making that a smaller spear, and we're can only go beyond, can't go beyond 18 inches wide, those kind of things. So I think one thing I want to say about our spring hearings, I've criticized them a lot over the years on various things. But the thing I often make myself think about when I get frustrated with how these meetings drag on sometimes is that, you know, where else in this country do we allow people to come out once a year and tell the DNR, and if any legislator is hanging out in the crowd, tell them what we think of these various laws and regulations? So to me, it's a great democratic process at work here that it can be mind-numbing. It can be very hard to sit through sometimes, but yet this is a great opportunity for public input.
Yeah. Dean, a comment from you? These guys probably stole a lot of your thunder.
I have just a little bit of thunder left. I'd concur with everything that Tim and Pat said about the spring hearing process. It can be mind-numbing, like Pat said, but again, you know, I mean, it's what, we're in our 85th, 86th year of these spring hearings, and I think most people know, or maybe they don't, but I mean, most of us writers know that this process started back in the day with Aldo Leopold, and I always say, we all say Aldo Leopold, but there were people beyond him whose names I can't remember who were also involved in creating the system that we have. It's the only one in the country. We're the only state in the country that does this. And as part of this, citizens can show up on that night with a resolution of their own, and there are guidelines on the website, the DNR website, of how to write a resolution. If you don't like a rule, you can write your own. And if it makes it up the chain, it could come back in a year or two or three as a possible rule change. So this is one way to be involved, and I'd highly encourage folks to do it. But the one interesting thing in the northern Muskie zone is now they're looking at extending. There's a question number 12 will be to extend the northern muskie season from November 30th to December 31st during open water years. So it wouldn't be for ice fishing, but if there were open water, they would allow muskie fishing through December 31st. That one's going to be on there. And then on the wildlife side, on the DNRs, there's three parts of this: DNR wildlife, DNR fish, and then Conservation Congress advisory. The DNR questions generally are proposed rule changes. On the wildlife side this year, there are just 8, and most of them have to do with trapping or reducing restrictions on firearms. So,
well, you guys were talking about mind numbing. I've been to those. There's other parts of your body that numb too. But I tell you what, it's worth it. And I want to thank the three of you for being with us, and we'll look forward to your next visit. I hope you're still up for it. Dean Bortz, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
Pat Durkin, thank you.
And thank you, Larry.
And Tim Isley, thank you so much.
Thank you. Spring is here.
Spring is here. Dean is the editor of Wisconsin Outdoor News. Pat and Tim are both freelance outdoor writers. Pat is president of the Wisconsin Outdoor Communicators Association. We'll have them back in probably 3 months, and we'll do it all over again. Tomorrow, we'll take a look at home improvement, discuss decks, and take your questions about your deck. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network.